Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Texas Lawyers Chapters, was recorded on Wednesday, September 30th, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on Texas's RFRA and the Houston HERO LGBT referendum. My name is Katie McClendon. I'm the Director of Publications at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our experts, Kathleen Hunker, Senior Policy Analyst with the Center for Economic Freedom at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, Josh Blackman, Assistant Professor of Law at South Texas College of Law, Eugene Volok, Gary T. Schwartz Professor of Law at UCLA School of Law, and John Eastman, Henry Salvatore Professor of Law and Community Service at Chapman University School of Law. Speaker bios were provided to you in the notice of the call, so we'll go ahead and get started. Kathleen, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Good afternoon. As just stated, my name is Kathleen Hunker. I have been asked to give a brief description of the environment in which the next Texas religious liberty debate will take place. I am sad to say that my outlook is a bit pessimistic, at least in the short term, but I do promise to end my presentation by commenting about the hope on the horizon. However, before I begin, I am obliged to say that my employer, the Texas Public Policy Foundation, has not taken a position on religious liberty, nor has it voiced an opinion on the merits of public accommodation ordinances, and as such, any of the observation or comments you hear are mine and mine alone. Americans are taught pretty early in childhood that the principle of religious liberty is fundamental and that it is woven into the very fabric of this nation. What we discover as we move into adulthood is that fundamental is just another way of saying that the right has near universal acceptance in theory. It's just found inconvenient in practice. The United States is seeing that pessimistic pattern play out with the expansion of government into all the nooks and crannies of social justice. Various combinations of public majorities and or bureaucratic agencies have projected their vision of a moral society onto the walls of the marketplace with the expectation that religious objectors will do one of two things. First, bend the knee, or second, stay at home. Now, the brewing conflicts are not confined to any one area of the law, nor are they confined to any particular or religion or practice for that matter. But that said, the most explosive collisions, at least recently, have orbited around traditional understandings of sexual morality. Indeed, commentators have long warned that the realization of same-sex marriage would herald in an unavoidable contest with the First Amendment's right to free exercise. Their warning certainly possessed a kernel of truth, but the exact intensity of that contest was not determined until earlier this past year, when the U.S. Supreme Court came down with the Obergefell decision and disrupted the consensus that was building over the proper balance between religious liberty and the public acceptance of sexual minorities. Merits of same-sex marriage aside, if current trends hold, then Obergefell is on course to be as sharp of a strike against religious liberty as the Smith decision. Only whereas Smith undercut the First Amendment judicial protections by dismissing the compelling interest test, Obergefell upended the protection that religious liberty receives through the give and take of legislative compromise. Let me explain that point for a minute, because I recognize that it's a serious charge. In the years leading up to Obergefell, 12 states and the District of Columbia enacted same-sex marriage laws. Each one of them had specific carve-outs for religious objectors. Now, I wouldn't classify all proponents of same-sex marriage as enthusiastic about the carve-outs. Likewise, those with principal objections would have probably preferred that the laws remain in draft form only. Nevertheless, it was understood that same-sex marriage would not move forward unless the act made some serious gesture of taking religious rights seriously. In short, objectors had real political leverage, and they could use that leverage to force concessions in their favor. This is evident from the titles that same-sex marriage laws assumed. Vermont passed an act to protect religious freedom and recognize marriage equality. Illinois passed the Religious Freedom and Marriage Fairness Act. Delaware, the Civil Marriage and Religious Freedom Act. Others followed similar naming conventions. The influence is also readily apparent in the concessions granted. Each state expressly exempted members of the clergy from a duty to solemnize marriages, and all but one extended that exemption to religious organizations. All of them covered protected objectors from government sanctions. and all but one protected covered objectors from a private suit. In addition, solid pluralities put protections in place for foster care services, fraternal orders, and housing designed for married couples. But as the Obergefell dissent noted, by imposing same-sex marriage judicially, the U.S. Supreme Court stalled that national discussion. It gave the country same-sex marriage, but at the same time, it took away whatever leverage religious objectors had in which to strong-arm concessions. Religious objectors still have the same need, but they have nothing in which to offer their political rivals in return. Essentially, the Supreme Court has left religious objectors to the mercy and graciousness of the victors, and did so in a way that reaffirmed that reservations for same-sex marriage are backward and possibly driven by animus. Understandably, the court's drive-by acknowledgement of religious liberty did not offer much comfort. So where do states like Texas go from here? Well, first and foremost, the answer is their version of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or as we lazily call it, RFRA. I know at least one of the other speakers plans on addressing Texas's RFRA statute in fuller detail, but for context, I'll summarize it as the legislators' attempt to recreate the compelling interest test. Each version carries slightly different amount of ornaments decorating its branches, but they each share a common three-pillar structure. First, the government cannot substantially burden an individual's right to free exercise their faith. Second, any substantial burden has to further a compelling interest. And third, the burden must be at least restrictive means accomplishing that interest. 17 states in 2015 introduced legislation to either create or supplement their state RFRAs. For my brief description, one might assume that RFRA's passage in Texas years ago would have preemptively closed the door that the court seemed bent on opening. It didn't, at least not entirely. The law still has enough ambiguity that religious objectors may in fact lose a good number of the predicted conflicts. In particular, the courts have been loath to vindicate a RFRA claim in the face of an anti-discrimination law. Instead, they've held that objective of non-discrimination represents a compelling interest and that the mechanisms are sufficiently tailored to pass review. The only way to fix that would be to pass a clarifying language which makes it explicit that private market actors can refrain from participating in events slash celebrations that go against their faith. I'll admit, though, that I am doubtful whether the political climate would accept such amendments. Proponents of gay rights are pretty clear that they held off opposition to SB 2065, the Pastor Protection Act, because it was viewed as reiterating current law. It's also probably the least controversial carve-out of the lot. A more expansive push would probably trigger an aggressive reaction and a quick retreat from those who dislike the criticism. The other main obstacle comes from the cities and towns sprinkled throughout Texas. Typically, the tension between state and municipal governments occurs when municipalities legislate in the spaces. The state intentionally declines to pass a regulation or to impose a duty, but since the state did not make a definitive proclamation, the dissenters of that vote look to lower levels of government to legislate in its stead. They fill the space with a local rule. We've seen this pattern throughout the United States. For instance, 8 cities in Kentucky have passed self-described fairness ordinances, which prohibit discrimination in housing, employment, and public accommodation. The last city, Midway, enacted theirs earlier this year and deliberately did not include a religious liberty exemption. The vote was in part a protest of Kentucky's own RFRA, which was passed in 2013. Indiana also saw its cities pass public accommodation ordinances, one of the reasons lawmakers sought to pass their own RFRA, but we all know how that turned out. Texas obviously has its own cities who are willing to legislate in the spaces, but there's another chapter of Texas' story that has not yet been written in other states. The division between local and state government has grown so contentious that cities are willing to legislate in direct violation of state law. The plainest example are the bag bans popping up throughout the state, including Austin and a few others. In this conflict, the Texas Health and Safety Code clearly states that cities cannot restrict the sale or use of a container or package in a manner not authorized by state law. That has not stopped, by the last count, 15 Texas cities from prohibiting plastic bag bans in their borders. I contend that even if the Texas legislature passed an expanded RFRA, the state will still have to tackle the internal jurisdictions who feel that state law should not stand between them and what they view as fair government. If enough cities rebel, then the legislature will be hard-pressed to enforce new protections, and much religious exercise will be chilled. Overall, advocates for religious liberty have a tough fight ahead of them. Now, I did promise to end on a chorus of hope. It's very likely that the forces emboldened by Obergefell will overreach in how much they dismiss religious liberty. anytime the government passes a new law, it has to handle what I call the aesthetics of enforcement. The more innocent the objection, the harsher the penalty, the more likely the anti-discrimination statute itself seems unjust. Certain proponents of gay marriage and gay rights are already flirting with that line. It would not take much to stumble over. As I said in the beginning, Americans do strongly believe in religious liberty. They do hold it as a fundamental right, and I have faith that they are willing to rally behind that right once intrusions go too deep. At that point, the political opposition to RFRA will unravel, and additional protections will become viable once again. With that, I do look forward to the Q&A, and I will leave it the floor to my fellow presenters, specifically Professor Josh Blackman, who will be the next one up. Professor?
Thanks, Kathleen. Hi, this is Josh Blackman. I teach the South Texas College of Law in Houston, Texas. And there are two main items that I want to discuss about religious liberty in the wake of Obergefell. The first was a memo released by Attorney General Ken Paxton regarding whether state officials can decline to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Now, this specific memo has been taken extremely out of context, so let me make very precise what the memo said and what it didn't say. The memo didn't say that clerks can just shut down and refuse to provide marriage license to same-sex couples. In fact, the memo said if you do something like that and no one in the office hands out the licenses, you're very likely violating the constitutional rights in Obergefell and setting yourself for a lawsuit. What the memo did say is that if it's possible in a clerk's office to accommodate religious objections, that should be done. And what does this look like? Say there are 15 employees working in the office, and one or two have a sincerely held objection. They think the religious exercise will be burdened by handing out these licenses. Their supervisor can accommodate this by assigning these tasks to someone else. Now, that doesn't mean you have one line for straight for opposite-sex marriage licenses, another line for same-sex marriage licenses. In fact, the memo says there can't be any sort of undue delay. But so long as a process is in place that a couple who obtains these licenses get ones in a timely fashion, that means that you're actually able to comply with the Texas Religious Freedom Restoration Act. This is not what happened in Kentucky, where the clerk, effectively Kim Davis, said, I will not authorize any licenses, nor will I allow my subordinates to. There may be some nuances in Texas law that specifically allows a elected clerk to let his or her subordinates do this action. But the Attorney General's memorandum on this point was quite clear, and it did not enable the sort of fly-by-night decision of clerks deciding not to or to basically block the doors to certain gay couples. The second aspect of the Attorney General's memo reflects judges and justices of the peace. Under Texas law, judges and justices of the peace are allowed to perform marriages, but they are not required to. And this is a very important distinction. They're allowed to, but they're not required to. So what the memo basically said is that the decision of a judge to perform any marriages is purely discretionary. And I think what the memo is hinting at is if a judge decides not to perform any marriages, because of some objection to a gay marriage, that's fine. But what becomes a problem, I think, and other jurisdictions have had this issue arise, Ohio and elsewhere, is what happens when a judge will perform opposite-sex weddings but not same-sex weddings. Okay? What, is someone making some noise in the background? Can you please mute your phone? Thank you.
Pardon?
Someone's
Hello?
Making some noise in the background. If they could please mute their phone.
Okay.
Thank you. Anyway, so the issue with the judges is this. If a judge decides to perform opposite-sex weddings but not same-sex weddings, that very well may open those up to an equal protection claim under the 14th Amendment, or however Obergefell defines the 14th Amendment. An additional metric is actually not imposed by the Constitution, but by the laws of the Texas Canons of Ethics. And I've spoken with a few friends who are state judges here. And those judges have said under the state canons of ethics, you cannot discriminate based on sexual orientation. This somehow made it through Austin and probably wouldn't have made it to the legislature, but it did make it through the state bar and the state ethics committee. So indeed, if you are a state judge and you decline to perform marriages for same-sex wedding, you probably run afoul of this law. Now, a corollary of this is a bill that Governor Abbott signed a few months ago called the Texas Pastor Protection Act, And this bill effectively says that religious organizations and those who work for religious organizations cannot be required to, quote, solemnize any marriage or be punished for refusing to provide services for these marriages. And ostensibly, the bill was meant to protect pastors from being forced to engage in same-sex weddings. And this part I'm not exactly sure, but the phrase religious organization seems to be defined quite broadly. And it's not clear if that applies to various religious nonprofits or perhaps even religious for-profit organizations, such as the Hobby Lobby Corporation, which was held by the Supreme Court to be a closely held, you know, religious for-profit corporation. But all of these efforts are basically boiling down to the fact that under Obergefell, the burden is now on the individual to prove why he will not issue a license or provide services to same-sex couples. My good friend Eugene has written at some length about how the First Amendment interplays here. I won't get too much into that, but for the case involving the Bakers and the Florists, there's a free speech argument here as well as a religious liberty argument. The second topic I'd like to discuss affects something called the Houston Equal Rights Ordinance, or HERO, as it's known here. And this ordinance has had a very complicated history. So ostensibly, the law provides protections against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity, you know, an LGBT ordinance. This ordinance was enacted by the City Council last year. And there was some dissent about it, but it was enacted. Houston law has a very peculiar provision which allows the voters to vote on a referendum to basically put the bill up for a repeal by referendum. In other words, once a certain number of people in Houston vote for the bill to be put up for a repeal, on the next ballot, it's put for a subsequent repeal vote. So what happened here was that I think about 50,000 Houstonians voted to bring this ordinance up for repeal. What happened afterwards, it gets a little bit complicated, but the long and short of it is that the city secretary, who's an elected official, she certified the signatures. Subsequent to that, the city attorney, who basically works for the mayor, Mayor Denise Parker, he determined that nearly half of the signatures were not valid for a host of reasons, and he basically invalidated the referendum. This was appealed all the way up to the Texas Supreme Court, and the decision, I think, in June, the Texas Supreme Court ruled that the city attorney had no role in invalidating the signatures, and indeed that was a role for the city secretary. Basically, the city attorney had no role in certifying signatures at all. So this will be on the ballot in Houston in November, and it's been actually quite controversial. If you listen to the radio in town, there are ads about it nonstop. A famous Houston Astro player, Lance Berkman, has cut a number of advertisements supporting repeal of the ordinance. And one of the major points in favor of it has to do with what's called the bathroom bill, as it's often known, the idea that a transgender person who would be able to use a bathroom with which they identify and perhaps not the gender which they were born with. And Lance Berkman saying that, you know, he doesn't want, you know, troubled men coming into the bathroom where his daughter is. Needless to say, this has been a very controversial ad. I don't know how the votes will come on this, but Houston may be an interesting flashpoint in the debate about LGBT rights following Obergefell. I will stop here and turn it over to my good friend Eugene Volokh, who will discuss the other aspects of RFRA. Eugene?
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I wanted to start by talking more broadly about religious freedom, which is an issue that came up in the first segment. I support religious exemptions in various kinds of contexts. I think that in some respects anti-discrimination law has gone too far and that certain kinds of exemptions to it may be legitimate. But I think we need to understand what we mean and how difficult it is to define what we mean when we say there's this great American tradition of religious liberty and how we support religious liberty. Certain kinds of rights are, if not absolute, very close to it. Right to trial by jury in criminal cases. You know, there are really very few exceptions. Right to free speech, at least when we're talking about the government restricting speech based on content, there are some exceptions, but basically this is a very strong right which almost always prevails. Religious liberty, in the sense of an entitlement to exemption from generally applicable laws, just cannot fall into that category. regardless of what you think about Employment Division versus Smith and how to read the free exercise clause. The bottom line is, we cannot all have a right to do whatever our religious commands, period. So, for example, what if we feel we have an obligation to engage in honor killings of blasphemers? Or, something less aggressive, imagine that somebody thinks that there's a visitation of the Virgin Mary on your property, and so they decide to do a pilgrimage to your property. They feel a religious command to go on your property. Well, that can't prevail over your right to be free from trespass. Or say that people feel a religious obligation to reprint for free copies of your copyrighted book. Again, I don't think that kind of claim should prevail either. And in its most attractive form, I think, the right to religious liberty is articulated as the right to do what you feel your religion commands, so long as you don't really hurt others. So Madison, for example, wrote that religion should be immune from civil jurisdiction in every case where it does not trespass on private rights or the public peace. Likewise, when Jefferson defended religious freedom, he said, look, saying there are 20 gods or no god neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. The implication is when some people's religious practices do pick someone's pocket or break someone's leg, or perhaps cause even more diffuse but substantial harms to society, a religious freedom must yield. So if there is going to be a right, whether constitutional or statutory, to religious freedom, that right has to be understood as being limited and as varying greatly in force from context to context, depending on what kind of impact this right has on other people's rights. And of course, the perennial difficulty is this hot controversy about what counts as other people's rights. So some people believe that there's a basic right not to be discriminated against in various kinds of commercial transactions, whether employment, public accommodation, or in government services or anywhere else, based on sexual orientation. You could agree or disagree with that claim, but that is the assertion behind anti-discrimination laws. That's also the assertion behind same-sex marriage rights as against the government, and and claims that people shouldn't be able to discriminate against same-sex marriages, for example, in providing property or providing various services. So arguing in favor of religious liberty, it seems to me, isn't enough. We know that religious liberty isn't enough to trump private property rights. Generally speaking, religious liberty has not been seen as enough when employers, for example, have said, you know, for our religious reasons, we don't want to hire people of particular races, or we don't want to hire, say, women with young children. Religious liberty has not been understood as being forceful enough to trump these countervailing rights, even though, again, they're quite controversial, or at least have been quite controversial in the past. So I think the real question here is who decides? What should be the process through which these kinds of decisions are made? And it used to be back before Employment Division versus Smith, the answer was that courts decided. So that in principle, if somebody wanted a religious exemption from, say, an equal rights statute or a drug law or a trespass law or anything like that, courts would ask whether there's a compelling enough government interest and whether whether denying the exemption was necessary to serve that compelling government interest. So a court might say, well, there's a compelling government interest in preventing race discrimination, but not a compelling government interest in preventing sexual orientation discrimination, even though a state legislature or a city or even the federal government may have enacted such a statute. There is no compelling enough government interest. But unsurprisingly, courts were quite reluctant to make such judgments, to say, well, you know, you want to have a war on drugs, well, we just don't think drugs are that bad, or this particular drug is that bad. Or you want to ban discrimination because you think people have a right not to be discriminated against, well, we don't agree with you, they don't have such a right. Courts are willing to trump legislative judgment like that, I think, in certain kinds of situations. Right to marry is a classic example, right? Likewise, right to free speech and such. But when we're talking about claimed exemptions from a vast range of laws, drug laws, as I said, discrimination laws, copyright laws, duty to testify, all sorts of things like that, courts were really quite reluctant, even back when there was constitutionally mandated exemption regime back before Employment Division versus Smith, they were reluctant to grant these kinds of exemptions. A second option is to have this be done on a statute-by-statute basis. So, for example, the conscientious objector exemption from the draft did not come from courts. Courts, in fact, rejected any such exemption. And I think even if we were in the pre-Employment Division versus Smith, post-Sherbert v. Verner regime where there was supposedly strict scrutiny of burdens on religion, I think a court would say, look, there's a compelling interest in raising armies, and if the government wants to deny an exemption, that's necessary to serve that interest. But Congress, as a part of the political process, decided there ought to be such exemptions. And the same thing is true in a lot of other statutes. Title VII, for example, which bans religious discrimination, has an exemption for religious discrimination in employment by religious institutions. Likewise, some other kinds of anti-discrimination laws dealing with sexual orientation, many of them have these kinds of exemptions. So that's another possibility, although the Houston Equal Rights Ordinance, while it has some religious exemptions, doesn't have very broad ones. A third possibility is the one that comes up with the RFRA statute, such as the Texas Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And that does suggest that people who want exemptions from ordinances like the Houston Equal Rights Ordinance might, in fact, be able to get exemptions. If, for example, somebody might say, look, I don't want to have my bed and breakfast used for a same-sex wedding, and I invite you judges to conclude there's no compelling interest in making sure that everybody has access to every single bed and breakfast in town. There are lots of others that that people could use. Interestingly, the experience with RFRA, at least at the Supreme Court level, is that the U.S. Supreme Court has been much more willing to carve out exemptions under the federal RFRA, which is just a statute, than it ever was under the federal Constitution, back when it did think that there would be exemptions granted under the Free Exercise Clause. Part of the reason might be that when a court says there is an exemption because there's no compelling government interest as a matter of constitutional law, that decision is final. And a legislature can't say, no, we disagree. There is a compelling interest. That's part of the strength of the constitutional religious exemption model. But it's also a weakness because courts are very reluctant to trump the legislative will this way. Whereas under state RFRAs, if a court were to say, look, there ought to be an exemption from the Houston Equal Rights Ordinance, but it's just under the Texas RFRA. So if the state legislature wants to carve out an exemption from that, that is to say, an exemption from the exemption regime, it would be free to do that. So in that respect, these kinds of RFRAs may actually be more pro-exemption than the old constitutional exemption regime, because the rhetoric of them, and the reality isn't, well, we the courts are trumping the legislative will. Rather, it is we the courts are enforcing the legislative will, enforcing the legislative will, as embodied in the Texas RFRA. So, how courts are going to apply the Texas RFRA to Houston Equal Rights Ordinance, it's hard to tell how they're going to apply it. As Josh was pointing out. To people who claim an exemption from kind of an office duty to issue, say, marriage licenses, and then say, look, I just want my colleague to issue the same-sex marriage license instead of having me do that. Also hard to tell. Likewise, how it would apply the federal Title VII, which provides religious accommodations for employees, so long as the accommodation doesn't work in undue hardship, is also hard to tell. But I do think that, in a sense, Employment Division versus Smith, followed by the enactment of these kinds of RFRA-type statutes, has actually ended up helping religious exemption claims in many ways more than it has hurt them, at least in those states that have RFRAs.
Thank you all. We are actually waiting for Professor Eastman to call in. He should be calling in any moment now. But in the meantime, let me notify everyone of our next scheduled Teleforum conference call, which is going to be tomorrow, Thursday, October 1st at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll host a conversation about the fallout from last term's Horn versus U.S. Department of Agriculture. While we wait, do any of you speakers want to respond to anything that has been said?
Kathleen, anything?
Yeah, just something small. So Professor Volokh made a good point, which is to say that obviously religious liberty is not absolute, which is correct, particularly when you're talking about getting an exemption from a generally applicable law. However, what RFRA does and what a couple of the other types of provisions do is they don't necessarily state that you have an unassailable right to religious freedom. What it is an invitation for the religious beliefs of Americans to be respected and actually taken seriously. And the reason why this is necessary is because we've seen, if not in the law itself, and at least in the enforcement of a lot of regulations, that the government does not take religious claims seriously and is willing to put down very important religious beliefs because of even phantom harms that can be done on the public. And the example I will give is in New York, where one of the city agencies, although the exact one escaped me, decided to bring a claim against the public accommodation statute on a bunch of Hasidic Jewish shops along Brooklyn and parts of Manhattan. And the reason why is because these different shops had put up a single sign that's asked their customers to dress modestly. Now, what's interesting about this controversy is that it was never enforced, these particular signs. It was a request to the customers to sort of respect the religious values that the shop owners had. So no single person had brought a complaint to the city, and not a single person had said that they were denied service. But the notice itself was enough for the city to say, well, you actually violated the public accommodation statute because this is obviously discriminatory towards women. And so now these different shop owners are put on notice. There's a possibility of fines. There's a possibility of long-term litigation, simply because they were exercising an expression of their belief, and the city could not find a single person who was harmed. Now, the reason why a RFRA statute is necessary, and possibly even an exemption from public accommodation, is simply because it requires that the government give a reason, an actual reason that isn't phantom, that isn't imagined, and isn't conjectured by the court later on, for them to put this restriction onto religious proprietors. I've mentioned in a couple of my writings that you often see minority religious beliefs get the brunt of a lot of these types of legislation, A, because they don't have the political power to persuade the government to take their religious beliefs seriously, or B, you might even have the case where there's just not enough of them and not enough knowledge among the government that this is actually intruding. And so I see RFRA and I see a lot of these other types of statutes, again, not stating that there is an unassailable right to religious freedom, but simply that people with religious objections deserve to have their day in court and to have that moment come up for consideration.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's important, though, to recognize that religious liberty rights necessarily have to be considerably more limited than many other rights that we recognize as constitutional rights, in part because their scope is so much broader. They don't just deal with speech. They don't just deal with marriage. They potentially are exemption claims from virtually any law that regulates behavior, as I said, drug laws, trespass laws, duties to testify, and a variety of other laws. It's just, I think, also important to recognize that once we say that there ought to be religious exemptions, but they ought to be limited by what? Limited by the rights of others. Then we get these hot controversies about what constitutes the rights of others. Some people don't think that there is a right to be free from discrimination based on sexual orientation in private accommodations, privately owned public accommodations. In fact, that's, I think, the view in most states. Most states have not taken that view. Federal government hasn't taken that view. Other states and some cities believe that there is such a right. So that's what makes these controversies so difficult, at least as a legal matter. The political difficulties are a separate category. They're difficult as a legal matter because the sort of the basic principle, well, you know, religious freedom should be protected so long as it doesn't intrude on the rights of others, runs into the question of what counts as a right of others. And here, but here I think I agree that RFRAs, I think, are a good solution to this because they put courts in a position where they can step in and say, well, is there really a burden on the rights of others? Is this really something that needs to be done? But ultimately, if the state legislature were to say that civil rights laws trump religious liberty claims, it can do that. Interestingly, by the way, the Texas RFRA actually specifically does say that federal and state civil rights laws do trump the state RFRA. There's a provision in the state RFRA that says this will not apply to federal and state civil rights laws, except insofar as it's religious organizations that are claiming certain kinds of exemptions. But, of course, the Houston Equal Rights Ordinance is not a state law. It's a local law. So, again, you have the question of who decides under the RFRA, so long as the court says there's no compelling interest. It's the state legislature. It's not every locality.
Just to build off of that, one of the interesting points, of course, with the upcoming challenges between state and local laws is because, again, as I mentioned during my presentation, that you have a lot of cities who are pushing back against explicit directions in Texas law and in the codes. So this is sort of a kind of federalism taken from state to federal, moving down to federal to city. And the Texas Constitution is pretty clear that state law takes precedence, that it does preempt when there's a direct line of cases or direct line of statutes. What's interesting, though, with the ordinances, of course, is this is sort of in the spaces where Texas legislature hasn't explicitly stated you can't put these civil rights in place, and so how do they come to that conclusion? Like, how do they navigate through?
I'd like to welcome Professor John Eastman. And Professor Eastman, if you want to give a short presentation, and then after that we'll move into our question and answer period.
Sure. Thanks very much, and my apologies for not being able to join you right at the start of the hour. I hope I'm going to say a few things that don't repeat what's already gone ahead of me. The one piece I want to pick up on, though, is Professor Volokh's recognition that we've got a lot of points of conflict coming from religious exercise and the various public accommodation laws. And I want to back up a step on that and ask the question how that came about. And it came about from a pretty dramatic expansion on our understanding of public accommodations. Public accommodations at the old common law was the rare hotel inn, as they say in those days, in the middle of nowhere, at the highways and byways of the realm. And you got a grant from the king to build that inn, and your agreement with the king was that you would take all travelers, unless they had a communicable disease or otherwise made it impossible for you to accommodate them. That limited nature of public accommodation is now vastly expanded into anything in the public square. If I walk out of my church or my synagogue or my front door of my house, I have effectively entered into the public realm, and all of the ability to choose who my associates were, who my business partners were, who my customers were, is out the window. While it may have made some sense to say if you're the only hotel in town, or you're the only gas station in town, or you're the only theater in town, you have to take all comers. But when you're one of 50 bakeries, or when you're one of 50 restaurants, that you don't get to decide who your clientele is going to be is a rather dramatic intrusion on what had previously been recognized as liberty. And so all of that has existed quite apart from the claims of religious liberty. They're just claims of liberty. Think about how many people who run small businesses who have signs up that you see that say, we reserve the right to refuse service to anyone. Well, under these public accommodation laws, that's no longer true, not even remotely. And so it's no surprise, I think, that we're finding this this conflict now on a much broader scale than we ever saw before. And it ought to ask, kind of force us to step back and ask whether it was a good thing that we went down that path in the first place. The second thing is, you see, tailored to this broadening of public accommodation statute is a revision on the freedom of conscience, freedom of religious exercise, to now using the language of freedom of worship, which is kind of the other side of that same coin of forcing religious exercise only into the sanctity of one's church or synagogue, and not how one conducts one's life in the public square, that you leave all those rights at the church door, if you will. Well, that's not what the founders understood freedom of conscience or freedom of religious exercise to be. The reason they didn't was they recognized that no law of man could force you to do things that violated the law of God, that there was a hierarchy in your obligations. And if we tried to force you to violate the higher authority, we were doing something wrong. And so there was always a great effort to accommodate the religious claims wherever possible. Quakers were not obligated to fulfill military service. In fact, even in the Constitution itself, the Oath Clause is designed, not many people think it's designed to accommodate atheists. Nothing could be further from the truth. It was designed, it says oath, and then it has in parentheses, or affirmation. That was designed to accommodate those who were, quote, religiously scrupulous of taking an oath, that their religious exercise, their religious faith, required them not to take oath, because in that particular interpretation of the biblical injunction, that would be taking the name of the Lord in vain. And so our Constitution specifically accommodates that because of the importance of recognizing that right of conscience, that right to comply with the higher authority and not the lower authority implemented by mere men. And so I think the RFRA statutes that recognize if there's a substantial burden on that conscience, on that right of conscience, on that free exercise of religion, then only the most compelling of governmental interests are going to get us over that hurdle. And that might be true if you're the only grocer in town. People can't get groceries and therefore feed themselves. But if you're one of 20 bakeries, it's just not true that the government has a compelling interest. And I think teasing that out is what unfortunately now in the context of the most controversial social issue of the day. But it seems to me there's a much deeper problem with our expansion of public accommodations law and a real threat to liberty coming down the pike, well beyond the current controversy.
Thank you. I will now open the floor to your questions. In a moment, you will hear a prompt that will say, the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then pound. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt that will say, your microphone has been turned on, you have the floor. We will be answering questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone keyboard.
Well, let me. This is John Eastman. Let me ask Eugene Volokh whether he agrees with me that the part of the problem coming up here is this very expansive notion of public accommodations to include basically any business, any service, anything that one does in the public square, virtually.
John, I agree with you as a policy matter. I'm Jewish. I'm irreligious. I'm Russian extraction. If somebody were to tell me, I don't want to host your wedding, or maybe I don't want to host your wedding because I'm Jewish too, and you're a Jew who's marrying a non-Jew, I think I'd say, well, it's kind of insulting, but hey, there are lots of places to host a wedding who are perfectly happy to take my money. I think that would be a very sensible position to take. However, lots of people disagree with John and me on this, and they believe that there is a basic right, not a constitutionally secured right, because it's a right against private action, but a basic right to be free from discrimination based on certain attributes in a wide range of market transactions. To them, it's a right kind of like the right to be free from defamation, or the right to be free from trespass, or the right to be free from nuisance, or other rights that the common law has traditionally recognized those rights. They think, well, that the law, common law and statutory law in this instance, should grow to also recognize these other rights. We disagree on this. That is to say, John and I on one side and those people on the other, at least as to a large range of accommodations. My view about public accommodations is quite complicated, but I certainly think that the federal model, the Title II model, which limits bans on public accommodation to certain kinds of places, has a lot to recommend it for the reason that that John mentions. But again, there is this disagreement. And I think it's good, actually, given Employment Division versus Smith, that that disagreement isn't going to be hashed out by courts who decide, well, is there really a compelling interest in preventing such discrimination? Is this really a private right to be free from discrimination, or is this not a legitimate right? However, one of the advantages of state RFRAs is courts could say, look, the legislature told us to make these decisions, told us to judge how compelling these interests are. We're going to conclude the interest is not that compelling, but, hey, we're not making any final judgment that's binding on majorities in Texas. If the Texas legislature or the Texas voters indirectly want to indeed recognize this as a basic right to be free from discrimination, public accommodations is a basic right that trumps religious liberty claims, they are free to do that. So I think again, the state RFRA model is a good one, and one of the things it does is it shifts things from the local level to the state level in this kind of situation. From the local level to courts in the first instance, and then the legislature, if the legislature disapproves of what the courts do. And if you really are kind of a localist, if you really do believe that there ought to be a lot of discretion about these kinds of things left to the voters and the representatives in each particular city, then in that case, that's bad. But if you think that the best unit for a lot of these decisions is neither too high, neither the federal government, nor too low, not the local government, but instead is the state, then again, the state RFRA model may be better, both in the federal free exercise clause model and in the model of where essentially every legislative entity decides for itself whether to carve out a religious exemption from a particular law that it enacts.
Hi, this is Josh, and I have a question perhaps for John and Eugene. I'm watching the debate play in Houston, and the debate basically is this. Are you in favor of equality, the Human Equal Rights Ordinance, or are you basically a bigot who opposes equality? I can see the same sort of debate playing out nationwide, where one side views this as a fundamental protection of religious liberty, and the other side says this is pure outright bigotry. How do you think this debate plays both in the state level and in nationwide level?
Well, I think at one point you just have to say, look, I'm running a child care center, and I now, under the proposed ordinance or the ordinance that is now up for the referendum, if somebody is a cross-dressing man who claims he's a woman, comes in and wants to apply to be my room supervisor, under this ordinance, I have to say that's perfectly fine, and I don't have any judgment to be made on whether I think the conduct and the message that conduct is sending to these young children is harmful. And the imposition on my right and the parents' rights and the children's right, is, in my view, vastly outweighs this kind of tenuous claim of you have to treat me equally no matter how outrageous my conduct, because I've defined it as gender identity, gender orientation that you're obligated to respect. You know, what an unbelievable intrusion on liberty and to have different views on core contested issues of the day. And so this is no longer a live and let live movement. This is now kind of a tyrannical imposition of one side of a debate against another side of a debate about the very moral foundation of the conduct at issue. And the notion that we're treating that as something akin to racial discrimination and lunch counters, I think is just a real stretch. And if as a society we're not able to make more critical judgments and distinctions than that, then we've really lost our way.
And anyway, just FYI, the ordinance does not apply to kindergartens, daycare centers, or nursery schools. It's interesting.
Right. Precisely because they didn't want the kind of argument that would be made. But it applies to a whole lot of other things that are you know, but one step removed from that.
Let's go to our first question.
I'm sorry?
Can we go to our first question?
Of course.
Once you hear the prompt, you may ask your question.
Good afternoon. This is Michael Massingale. I want to thank all the speakers. This is a great topic, and I'm glad to see the Texas chapters sponsoring a teleforum. I wanted to direct my question to Professor Blackmon and the subject matter of judicial codes of ethics as they relate to judges performing weddings. In Texas, judges are permitted to marry people, but it's not required. The scenario that I have in mind that I didn't hear you address, Professor Blackmon, is a judge who decides to not perform any weddings whatsoever to avoid entanglement in this issue. I understand that at least one state's ethics commission has ruled that it would be unethical for a judge to decline to perform any weddings if that were motivated by the desire not to perform a same-sex wedding. So could you address that and also maybe address what you are aware of happening around the country to address the conscience rights of judges?
Right. So thank you. And Justice Massengill is a judge here in the First Court of Appeals in Houston. So I think the short answer isn't clear. And the reason why is with judicial proceedings, we're not dealing with the state legislature. We're dealing with the state bar. And I don't need to surprise anyone saying that the state bar in Austin is captured by people who probably have a very specific view of these sorts of matters. Justice Massengill can perhaps speak to that as well. So I think there's a serious risk that if indeed a judge makes a statement to the effect of, because I am morally opposed to officiating gay weddings, and that statement is somehow recorded, and then the judge performs none, I can imagine a state ethics proceeding saying, well, you are now effectively making a decision not to do something because of the gay marriage ruling. There was actually a judge, I think he was in Ohio somewhere, or I can't remember, and effectively he had to resign because he said, the ethics board said, if you decline to perform these weddings, you would actually be in violation of your judicial canons of ethics. So I think you very well may see state judges who stay quiet and say nothing. And if someone asks, then they'll probably stay quiet and say, well, I'm too busy, which might be the best answer.
So here's what I think is a big part of the problem. On the one hand, judges are expected to be impartial, and they're often told essentially not to say things and do things that suggest that they are biased on various bases. One thing, for example, that they're told, at least in the federal system, not to do is not talk about political candidates, and or at least not denounce political candidates or political parties, not be visibly participate in politics. Likewise, if judges say things, especially in the courtroom, that are perceived as racist or harshly anti-gay, that's something that that may be condemned and may lead to discipline on the grounds that it makes litigants feel uncomfortable in the courtroom, be more specific than uncomfortable, makes litigants reasonably fear that the judge will be prejudiced against them in the courtroom. The difficulty is, as with many principles, if you take it to its logical conclusion, it runs up against other principles. If a judge, for example, publicly says, you know, I don't think that Obergefell is a good decision because I think that same-sex marriage, there is no such right because I think there's a difference between same-sex marriage and opposite-sex marriage. Opposite-sex marriage is good for society, same-sex marriage is not. People can say, aha, that very statement makes us worry that as gays and lesbians, we won't get a fair shake in your courtroom. Not a ridiculous worry. I can see why they might be concerned about that. But the consequence is then the judges would be barred from expressing this vast range of viewpoints on a vast range of important topics. What's more, let's say the judge is a member of, in fact, a prominent member of a religious group that sharply condemns homosexuality. People could say, aha, the very fact that he appears in that church, the very fact that he's an elder in his church, even if he doesn't say anything about homosexuality, the very fact that he participates in this religious group, well, that makes us worry that he is, in fact, anti-gay and will be biased against us. So again, if you take to its logical conclusion this concern about any action or speech on the part of a judge that might suggest to some reasonable people that the judge would be prejudiced in his decisions, then the consequence is that judges would be would be barred from normal religious practice, normal speech, and normal actions that I think they, even though they're judges, they're also human beings. They're also citizens who should be free to do those kinds of things. I would say the same thing with regard to judges who decide, I don't want officiated marriages at all. And if somebody asks, I'll tell them the truth. It's because I'm not comfortable with same-sex weddings. It doesn't fit my religious belief system, so I just want to get out of this altogether. Say, aha, you have explained honestly why it is you do this, and that reveals you to be a bigot, and therefore you're not fit to be a judge. That, I think, is way too much of a burden on the rights of judges, even when the underlying principle, which is that judges shouldn't do things or say things that make people reasonably doubt their impartiality, that underlying principle has some force. It just shouldn't have that much force. So that's why I think that judges ought to have the right to stop performing weddings. But unfortunately, Josh is right that this is a right that is tenuous in the current environment for the very reasons that we've been hearing.
And this is Josh briefly. In California, as I understand it, a judge can no longer be a member of the Boy Scouts because they, well, for the time being, they discriminate against gays. So actually, state judges mm-hmm. can no longer be members of the Boy Scouts of America.
As, they've
changed their policy, but that's you're effectively excluding someone from public civic discourse because they're private views.
Yeah. And I should say, John, I think, was quite right. I think it was John who said that this isn't about just leaving people free to do whatever they want, that aspect of the gay rights movement. I think there are a lot of gay rights advocates who are interested in just leaving people free to do what they want and perhaps to get equal benefits from the government. But in fact, the bulk of the gay rights movement that I have seen, that's not what they just want, what they want to do. They also want to suppress a wide range of both private action and kind of off-the-job action by government employees that they see as undermining equality. It isn't just a claim of liberty, the way Lawrence v. Texas was a claim of liberty, and the way Obergefell might be seen in some measures a claim of liberty or at least equal treatment by the government. This is a claim of equality, inequality in private transactions. And the fact is, equality in private transactions routinely runs up against liberty concerns. Doesn't mean the liberty concerns should always win, but we all have to understand that there is an inevitable danger, maybe justified, maybe not, but inevitable danger to liberty in any kind of equality campaign such as this.
It's also important to remember that in many cases, religious liberty claims, or at least the beliefs, are sort of immutable. We often describe orientation as immutable. We describe race and gender as immutable. But what you believe, you really can't change that on your own will. You can open yourself up to discourse. You can open yourself up to debate. But eventually, the other side has to persuade you. At most, you can remain silent. So it's not like the reservations are going to go away. What it is they're going underground. And the question, of course, is then, do you want to have a society where it's really just no public expression of what's immutably part of someone's life and their, and pretty strongly part of their life?
Let me just offer a friendly amendment. It's a very different kind of immutable, it seems to me, than race, because we know that religious beliefs are constantly mutable and mutating. People change change religions quite often, but also I think many religious people, maybe deeply religious people, will tell you that over time their particular attitudes within the religious belief system have changed. They think they have changed their views, maybe, for example, on questions such as homosexuality, maybe on questions such as how one should react to things that one thinks are sinful, but what kind of walling yourself off from sin are necessary and what are not. I think all of us have experience, either in our own lives or in the lives of people we know, with religious beliefs being changing. But I do think the premise of a lot of, in fact, anti-discrimination laws that treat religion kind of like race is that those beliefs shouldn't be, when they change, they shouldn't change because the government demands that they change, or the government threatens you, or even private employers threaten you with firing if you don't change your beliefs or if you don't depart from your beliefs. But I would resist the notion that religious beliefs are immutable, given how often they mutate.
They're immutable in the way that it's not in your control in what you believe. It's sort of structured around sort of the information that you've been given and how your brain sort of slots everything in place. I don't mean that it doesn't change at any point in your life. Of course it does. Everyone goes through different types of conversions or points where there's doubt or points where there's conviction or complete 180s on their convictions. But at the end of the day, you don't necessarily choose to believe something. it's not necessarily in your control. It is to a degree you can open yourself up to different points of view, but you can't persuade yourself. You have to be persuaded.
Let's go to our next question.
In light of the Texas RFRA statute, which makes the provision for civil rights, I don't have the exact wording in front of me, and then considering the U.S. Supreme Court decision in the Bob Jones case, where the Supreme Court decided that there was a compelling government interest in non-discrimination. Now, different facts. This was a university that practiced racial discrimination and wanted the 501c3 or tax exempt status. But if one looks at the fact that courts take judicial recognition of a sort when they see cities passing ordinances like the HERO ordinance or what some of the other cities have considered and embraced. And so now that there is a perceived elevation through the Supreme Court of Obergefell ruling that there is equality, as Professor Volokh has mentioned, for LGBT rights, and with cities moving the way they are, how can a state like Texas, if Texas wanted to move to strengthen the RFRA and clarify what they mean by the civil rights component, how would a state do that?
Well, a state can do lots of things in state statutes. So currently, the Texas RFRA says that except with regard to religious institutions, this chapter does not establish a defense to a civil action or criminal persecution under a federal or state civil rights law. Now, the Houston Equal Rights Ordinance is not a federal or state civil rights law. It's a local law. But if the Texas legislature wanted to, it could amend A to say federal, state, or local civil rights law. And that would be that. Then there would be no Texas RFRA claim. On the other hand, the state legislature could also say that, for example, anti-discrimination laws are entirely a matter of a state interest and not local interest, and will preempt all local anti-discrimination laws. Maybe there's some Texas state principle that home rule principle that precludes that, but certainly that's something that the legislature could do, assuming that the Texas Constitution empowers it to do that, and I suspect that it does. Or the Texas legislature could say, we're not going to preempt local ordinances, but we're going to say, by definition, there is no compelling interest for purposes of the Texas RFRA. Government interests in banning discrimination that Texas state law actually does not ban. So I think the legislature has lots of flexibility here. Now, one interesting question raised by that you raised is, what are courts likely to do? And it's true that courts have often rejected claims to religious exemptions from anti-discrimination laws, finding that there are compelling government interests. In Bob Jones, the Supreme Court specifically mentioned the compelling government interest in preventing race discrimination, especially in publicly supported education, because the question there had to do with tax exemptions and the benefit that that provides. Likewise, some lower courts have found that there is a compelling government interest in preventing, say, race and sex discrimination in employment. At the same time, in the late 80s and then in the 90s, there was a spate of cases in various states having to do with housing discrimination based on marital status. Various states and cities banned housing discrimination based on marital status, and some landlords claimed religious exemptions, saying, we don't want to rent to unmarried couples, they're unmarried straight couples, because we feel that would make us complicit in their sin of fornication, which they're going to be doing in the apartment they rent from us. And interestingly, some courts accepted that argument and some courts didn't. So how exactly this would play out is hard to tell for sure. A court might say, look, sexual orientation discrimination is different from race discrimination. Sure, lots of people think it's just the same, but in fact, our state legislature doesn't seem to think it's the same. It bans race discrimination, but not sexual orientation discrimination. Lots of other states don't think it's the same, so therefore, for purposes of compelling interest analysis, it's not the same. Or they might say public accommodation discrimination based on sexual orientation is not the same as employment discrimination. Employment discrimination is a question of your livelihood. Public accommodation discrimination, you know, it's often in many situations just a question of finding the same service broadly available from lots and lots of other people. So it's hard to predict exactly which way courts would come out in this, although I agree certainly many courts would be inclined to say, yes, there is a compelling interest in banning sexual orientation discrimination, and if that's so, they'd reject the RFRA claims unless the state legislature specifically strengthens the RFRA in that respect.
Unfortunately, our time is up. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Kathleen Hunker, Professor Blackman, Professor Volokh, and Professor Eastman for joining us today. Thank you also to our audience. We welcome your feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Please join us for our next teleforum tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.